From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to present to this convention the name of Hubert Horatio Humphrey as nominee for the President of the United States. Thank you very much.
40 years ago, the Democratic National Convention made history, not for what happened inside the convention, but for the mayhem that erupted outside. The streets of Chicago turned into a battle zone as police and National Guard troops wielding billy clubs and tear gas waded into the crowds of anti-war protesters. Many people denounced the violence. Senator Abraham Ribicoff accused the Chicago police of Gestapo tactics, while Mayor Richard Daley defended his force.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
Today, we'll look back at that time, not just 1968, but the legacy of the 60s, the protest against the Vietnam War, the rise of the modern conservative movement, and the emergence of a new kind of politics.
The 1960s was a time in which nothing was banal. Nothing was boring. Everything was outsized. Everything was the end of the world.
First, a conversation with one of the 60s iconic figures. Tom Hayden was a founder of Students for a Democratic Society, and later one of the Chicago Seven, the men charged with and later acquitted of conspiring to incite a riot at the 68 Democratic Convention. In the 1980s and 90s, Hayden joined the political mainstream, serving in California's State Assembly and Senate. Tom Hayden stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the legacy of the 60s.
I often wonder if I was 5 years older, I'm 67 or thereabouts, whether I would have missed the 60s. It happens that I graduated high school the year that Kerouac's On the Road was finally published. It was also the year of the Little Rock school integration at the point of federal troops. It was 2 years after the Montgomery bus boycott. I think those were precursors of the 60s.
And then Kerouac's book, that had a big impact on you, didn't it?
It had a big impact on everybody. I was part of the hitchhiking generation, but by its very nature, it didn't organize a generation. It touched the feelings of isolated individuals, as did the character Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye, who, as you recall, thought the whole world was a mess. And you find out at the end of the book that he's in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that. And I came out to California as a student editor, and I interviewed Martin Luther King on a picket line. I was still more drawn to a career in journalism, so I was thinking in terms of how the interview with King would get me on the front page of the Michigan Daily, more than to be a suggestion that I should put aside the pen or pick up the picket sign or both.
You were the observer rather than the activist.
I was a kind of observer, I'm ashamed to admit, but I went with students that year to Fayette County, Tennessee, because of something I'd read about sharecroppers displaced from the land, and we brought them food. And that's where I encountered the first sheriff coming up out of the darkness, and my knees buckled, and we were run out of town by maniacs with chains and clubs. And all of these experiences were personal, but also, and I don't want to dwell on it, but I mean, it was quite an incredible time. You know, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Crisis, which brought the nuclear dread right home. We were closer than ever since to an actual nuclear war. That got into your bones. We were all draft age, too. But things were happening. Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Betty Friedan wrote Feminine Mystique. Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed. Frantz Fanon wrote The Wretched of the Earth. These books all were published in the space of about 1 year, 1961, 1963. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was formed. This was the blossoming of what I thought must be a social revolution.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back to 1962 when you and your fellow SDSers.
As long as you know that's 45 years ago. We're still talking about something that happened a very long time
Absolutely.
ago.
Absolutely. which has been immortalized in various
not
books.
Not quite.
The Port Huron Statement, you were the lead writer of that statement. I mean, it has turned into one of the most important political manifestos, I think it's fair to say.
I would say it's an asterisk for a generation. But
when you look back on that document, how well do you think it still holds up today?
Well, it's got all of the strengths and weaknesses of sophomoric writing, basically. I mean, there's a huge amount of utopianism, idealism that only a young person could have written it. If you looked at it, this is not Karl Marx. This is not C. Wright Mills. This is not John Dewey. This is a self-confident generation finding its voice, really.
And to some degree, rejecting an older generation of leftists, too.
No, there's a generational friction that I think accompanies all these movements. I regret it because it means that the older left had been broken by McCarthyism. It's not entirely a good thing to be new because it means your predecessors have been completely displaced. The other thing about the Port Huron Statement that I do think is lasting is the notion of direct action or participatory democracy as an alternative to merely voting.
So democracy at that time meant you went to the polls, and that's what it meant.
Well,
it meant more
than that because I couldn't vote. I could be drafted. Blacks in the South couldn't vote. So getting the vote was no small matter, but it was more than getting the vote. It was extending the opportunity to have a voice in decisions beyond the ballot box to the community, to the university, to the workplace.
So where did leadership fit into this whole idea of participatory democracy? I mean, your movement back in the 60s still needed leaders. You were one of them.
The easy answer is that leaders should be elected and rotated and held accountable. And even that is problematic. But there's a role for leadership, but too much of history is considered in terms of leaders. I cringe at things I'm blamed for and things that I'm given credit for. It's all part of the inflation of the individual.
And give me an example of that.
The Port Huron Statement is kind of in between. It is true that I wrote a very long single-spaced draft. It is also true that about 65 people sat for 5 days in small circles, breaking it into component chapters and reconceptualizing it and then voting on it and then turned it back to me for a final polish. So do I get all that credit or does the larger group get that credit? Those are the kind of things that make me cringe.
That whole process, that 5-day process after you had come up with this draft and all these dozens of people were weighing in on it, that must have been a very invigorating time. Was it frustrating too?
No, I would say it was euphoric. It's one of those born-again moments, I guess you could call it, what the Christians call born-again, the New Left would call consciousness-raising. It was really quite something, and I could only compare it to other euphoric moments that occur in the initial phase of a social movement, a new social movement, where there's a breathtaking solidarity and an intensity that you want to live for. Like Seattle in 1999 would be a similar moment. It's an awakening.
Now, when you look back on what happened later in the 60s, and particularly your own involvement in the 60s, you were certainly one of the most visible activists during that time. Do you feel like you more or less lived out the principles that you had spelled out in the Port Huron Statement?
Awkwardly. For instance, I've always had an extreme ambivalence about the question of leadership. And I've come to believe that it could be my weakness, can't resolve it, or it could be that it's simply not resolvable given my other beliefs. Sometimes, you know, it's not resolvable because in the electoral system we have, if you want to run for office, you're naturally going to inflate yourself. You know, you're going to take credit for things. You're going to want your name on bills because you can't go to the voters and say, I don't do anything because I don't believe in leadership.
Right. And spoken by a former politician.
Right. So, you know, it's kind of the system imposes certain penalties in life if you choose, for instance, to become involved in politics.
Well, I know to bring our story even closer up to the present here, you teach college students today. I'm sure you give a lot of talks at colleges. What's your sense of how today's activists compare to the way you folks were back in the 60s?
today's activists as opposed to today's students?
Well, I'll leave that open to your interpretation.
Well, I think that the 60s caused a lot of reforms that have become part of the status quo. The free speech movement, you know, that started over the placement of tables.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it started over moving tables from Sproul Hall to Bancroft and Telegraph and so on. I don't think that a university would be foolish enough to ignite anger over an issue like that, although they're capable of foolishness. I understand that. What I'm saying is that the universities have now become like a soundproof room where it's really hard to shout and feel that you're being heard. You can read Leon Trotsky if you wish. You can read Che Guevara's diaries. You can unearth feminist treasures. You can, the stuff that was forbidden in a time when that was synonymous with it must be radical or revolutionary, the forbidden is now permissible. Secondly, the draft is gone, and there's nothing to get your attention like a military draft. It's an unbelievable existential crisis when you're in that young and transitional period. And the other thing that's not given much attention is, you know, I went to the University of Michigan for $100. I can't remember if it was $100 a year or a semester.
Cheap, in other words.
Yeah, we had an idea like they have in France, in Mexico, in most civilized countries, that higher education should be free, state subsidized, a state investment in the future. Kind of like Social Security for the elders and free college education for anybody who wants it and is qualified for the youth. Now, it's been brought under the forces of the market where students are, their discretionary time is rationed out very carefully. The competitive stakes are very great when you're trying to get in. I don't remember anybody in my generation having to apply to 25 colleges looking for the good fortune of being admitted to one or two. Now we have a market model, not completely, but a market model that's displacing the old model of college funding. And that's got to have an effect on behavior. And it's got to induce more apathy than alienation, I would think.
Hmm. Which is interesting because I know apathy was one of those words that you and your fellow activists back in the early 60s railed against.
Well, yeah, we railed against it. But remember, we had discretionary time. I could drop out of the university and nothing would happen. I could go to jail in Mississippi, nothing would happen. I could return and pay my $100 and get back in. This is a treadmill that today's students are on that we didn't face. We thought our life was, you know, the future was a treadmill, the gray flannel suit and all that, but nothing compared to the pressure on this generation of students.
Tom Hayden, talking with Steve Paulson. Hayden was one of the founders of Students for a Democratic Society and later a state assemblyman and senator in California.
The student now goes to college to proclaim rather than to learn. The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated.
Richard Nixon's Vice President Spiro Agnew speaking at a Republican dinner in 1970.
A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals.
1968 was a turning point in the Vietnam War. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army launched the Tet Offensive that January. In March, a squadron of American soldiers slaughtered hundreds of unarmed civilians in the hamlet of My Lai. 1968 was also the year that one young man from Wisconsin, Gil Halstead, first became truly aware of the war. Since then, Vietnam and the war have become almost an obsession for him. Today, Gil is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. He also considers himself a veteran of the anti-war movement. Earlier this year, he went to Vietnam for the third time to report on the 40th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. He also went to try to sort out his own sense of guilt and anger about the war.
In 1973, I was arrested during a sit-in on the White House steps. I'd torn up my draft card the year before, humming a chant like this one. As I put the pieces of the card in an envelope and sent them to President Nixon. Country Joe's anti-war anthem was one I used to play at high volume on my stereo. And it's one, two, three, what are we for? Opposing the war was my reason for being back then. But not just opposing it, I read everything I could get my hands on about Vietnamese history and America's role in the war. I sent letters to Viet Cong prisoners being held in tiger cages in South Vietnam, and I copied them to Vietnamese and American officials. I met with Viet Cong representatives in Montreal right after the Paris Peace Accords were signed. Now, back in Vietnam for my third visit, I came to report on healing the wounds of war. One wound in particular, the My Lai Massacre.
We're investigating a situation wherein at the present moment, we can say that we know beyond a doubt that well over 200 Vietnamese and maybe up to 500 of them were killed, and that isn't all of the story. There were numerous rapes that took place. The houses were all destroyed. Six additional sub-hamlets were burned to the ground. All of the animals were destroyed. It's just not the people in Taft Fort Barker that's on trial. In the eyes of the American public, it's the Army. It's you and it's me, and it includes our country.
That's Army Lieutenant General William Pierce, the author of the official Army report on the massacre. The massacre in My Lai took place on March 16, 1968. I was there to report on the 40th anniversary of that event that I will always consider a war crime, but that's never been acknowledged officially as such by the U.S. government. Yes, the Vietnamese committed atrocities too, against both American soldiers and each other. But My Lai has always been, for me, a personal responsibility as an American. We have honored our war dead, but not theirs. And this year, for the first time, the Vietnamese communist, by definition anti-religious government, agreed to allow a day-long traditional Buddhist ceremony for the dead to honor the victims of the massacre. A huge tent was set up in front of the towering granite statue at the center of the official My Lai Massacre memorial site. Inside the tent, you couldn't see the statue. It's of a woman, fist raised in the air, with a dead baby in her arms and the corpses of two other people at her feet. Monks with shaved heads sat in rows in front of a platform where huge bowls full of incense burned, and musicians played traditional stringed instruments and beat gongs and drums. A Vietnamese woman I'd met in Saigon broke down in tears as we entered the tent.
The sounds of the music make me move. Yeah. Because all the people pray for the victim. 40 years ago, in the afternoon time like this, by that time I was a child, maybe the same age like this, I see my mom cry, and I didn't know because she said that all the people was killed.
Later that day, I stood in a crowd of Vietnamese mourners in a reconstructed hut on the memorial grounds. I was struggling to hear the conversation between a Vietnam veteran and a survivor of the massacre, whose family had lived in the original hut that had been destroyed during the massacre. They held hands, tears streaming down their faces. Later, the Vietnam veteran told me the woman was thanking him for coming and asking why the American government had never apologized for the massacre. The following day, at the official anniversary of the ceremony, Vietnam veteran Mike Baim played his violin as he has for the past several years. His way of honoring the dead and apologizing for the massacre and trying to heal the wounds of the war. Mike has always inspired me, and I guess I was there to apologize too. My efforts to end the war came too late to prevent the massacre and too late to help veterans like Mike and others who lost limbs or a piece of their soul in that war. I regret that I got so caught up in idolizing the heroic Vietnamese people that I lost sight of the damage both sides in the war were doing to each other. After Mike's violin solo, a local Vietnamese folk group performed a spirited but melancholy song about the massacre. The lead singer had a missing hand, perhaps a war wound. He raised the stump over his head as he belted out the chorus.
(laughs)
All of the Americans I spoke to after the ceremony talked about the mixture of guilt and anger they felt about the war. Many of the veterans were angry that the massacre gets barely a mention in high school history textbooks now. But the Vietnamese I talked to had an entirely different approach. People like a 55-year-old Viet Cong Army veteran. His mother and sister were both killed in the massacre. Through a translator, he answered my blunt question, was he still angry about the massacre?
40 năm qua thì đối với gia đình chú thì coi như có nạn nhân là bị.
I still remember what happened in the past, but I want to change the pain into action. I want to close the past and towards a more brighter future.
Thầu thì lúc nào thì mình cũng vẫn để đó, nhưng mà em khiếp là.
As we talked, a group of American Quakers and Japanese peace activists were planting trees on the site of a new school to educate the children of My Lai. I still haven't made my peace with Vietnam. The war is still in my blood. I think I keep going back both to try to heal the wounds of mine that include a lot of guilt and the wounds of the people my country waged war on. But I can never feel those wounds as personally as the Vietnamese do.
I need to do this job.
Phan Phan Do, who works with the Quaker school projects in Vietnam, has an outlook on the war I keep trying to emulate. He has no love for Americans or the communist government he now lives under. He protested the war while he was a student in Saigon. He's not interested, though, in placing blame or holding anyone accountable. He just wants to mend the wounds of the war.
Working with Americans is not easy in this part of the country where hatred still covers everywhere. I don't care because what I'm doing in my opinion, is doing something good for my people, you know. Not really country, but for my people first, because the definition of country can be defined differently, you know.
When I returned to Saigon, I had lunch with a couple I had met on the train. They were both teachers and had been born near the My Lai massacre site. They seemed truly happy to spend time with me and talk about their teaching. They fed me dish after dish of delicious food. They wanted to know about the chances of their children coming to study in the U.S. I asked them if they wished the Americans had stayed and defeated the North Vietnamese, and they told me the question didn't make any sense to them. The war was over long ago, they said, and they were only interested in finding ways of bettering their lives and working towards a more prosperous Vietnam. That was the only time we talked about the war. The wife of the family preferred to talk about literature and was delighted that I had read The Tale of Q, an epic poem the Vietnamese consider the supreme achievement of Vietnamese literature. It was written in the early 1800s by Nguyen Du. It's about an upper-class woman who was forced to sell herself into prostitution to save her family, but she always maintains her sense of honor and is finally reunited with her true love. Its opening verse says much about the Vietnamese approach to life.
100 years in this lifespan on earth, how apt to clash talent and destiny. Men's fortunes change even as nature shifts. The sea now rolls where mulberry fields grow. One watches things that make one sick at heart. This is the law, no gain without a loss.
An excerpt from the Vietnamese poem, The Tale of Q. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Gil Halstead produced our story about the My Lai massacre. Have you had your own personal struggles with the Vietnam War? If so, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Called Talking John Birch Blues.
Back in the early 60s, New York's Greenwich Village seemed like the center of the world, or at least the center of the folk revival. The folk music scene was then the hub of bohemian culture and leftist politics. and Bob Dylan would become its biggest star.
Well, I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists was coming around. They was in the air, they was on the ground, they was all over.
Suze Rotolo met Dylan in 1961, and they soon became inseparable. Eventually, they broke up, but Rotolo's remained a mythic figure in historical accounts of Dylan, often written about, but never heard from. Now, she's written a memoir called A Freewheelin' Time. Anne Strainchamp spoke with Suze Rotolo.
Take me back to that period of time, in particular to New York, 1961. You met Bob Dylan at a folk concert, a kind of marathon all-day folk concert at Riverside Church. What was that first meeting like?
Well, I had already seen him perform. You know, there were a lot of musicians around in the different clubs and coffee houses, and he was around. He was one of many. He had a wonderful sense of humor, and he played with this other singer, Jack Elliott, and they were almost like a comedy act. And because I knew some of the musicians, I was backstage, and he was following me around a lot. It was kind of as if we knew each other already, but we had to get to know each other better.
I think at some point in your memoir you said, you know, you were both pretty sensitive, thin-skinned people, and that you found some kind of shelter in each other.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, in a way that goes with young love. You know, you create this little world together. But I think both of us were highly sensitive. I say in the book that we didn't have skin growing over and nerve endings.
Hmm. Dylan at that point was a relative newcomer to New York, but you grew up there when you were a red diaper baby, right?
Yes, as the children of communists were known.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So you grew up with leftist politics, and also you grew up in New York. I mean, you loved music and art and theater and poetry, and you lived in a city full of museums, and it seems like right away you began kind of introducing all of that to Bob Dylan, who was of course this kid from Hibbing, Minnesota.
Yes, well, his focus was music, whereas mine was, I was in different things. I was passionate about poetry, theater, art, and whatnot. And then it's an exchange of, he influenced me, I influenced him, but I certainly brought him into my world of the things where I went that I took for granted. It was in New York, after all.
You know, one of the things I love about the way you describe this early relationship is you were such equals, such peers, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the stories about girlfriends of musicians, especially musicians who went on to become famous as they were kind of living in the shadow of the great man or simply, you know, muse to the great artist. But it sounds like the two of you really had a relationship of equality at a time when that was less usual.
But that's the way it should be, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
And I guess I was too young and restless and curious to become anything else. You know, we were both young. That's what I try to emphasize. And it's usually a successful musician, whether male or female or anyone successful in whatever, they've already have acquired this fame and fortune. So their partners have to be part of that in some way, unless they're in another, is equally famous. But it's difficult. Whereas we were both young and he was becoming famous, but he wasn't yet. So we were equal.
When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right.
And one of the slightly uncanny things about reading your memoir is every now and then there's a little phrase kind of tucked in that I think, wait, I know that from one of Dylan's songs. Are you quoting from him, or did he quote from you in his lyrics?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I did do that. I did that in a few cases, but some might have been completely unconscious. They were just phrases, you know? I know people have referenced the rooster crowing at the break of dawn, and that was conscious. I knew that because I was setting the scene of they were there on Thompson Street in the Village back then. There was a place where you could buy live poultry and pick out the chicken you wanted, and then they would slaughter it and cut it up as you wanted. So we used to stay up all night. You know, nights started early and ended early in the morning, and you would hear If you're walking around in the village in those days, you would hear the roosters crowing.
There's some letters you got from him. You went off to Italy at one point, and he wrote you some really lovely, very young, but lovely love letters. There's one I remember he wrote, you know, I wrote this song, and you're in it, and then I wrote this other song, and you're in it, too. What were those songs?
Well, he was trying to get me to come home, so they were... And I was very confused about staying or coming home. It was as if I was discovering a life other than the smoky clubs of Greenwich Village and folk music, which was really oppressive. I wasn't a folk musician. It was a bit much after a while. I hadn't been to college, and this was kind of college for me. I was meeting all these people and discovering other poets and other music. And I was having a wonderful time, but the underlying thing was this pull to go back to the city and be with Bob.
Is Boots of Spanish Leather, is that about you?
Well, you know, that's about Spain and Spanish Boots of Spanish Leather. That's a perfect example of how something's translated into make art. You know, I was in Italy and I was away, right? So this song says Boots of Spanish Leather. It's a perfect example of fictionalizing something. He was writing a ballad.
So the facts are different, but the emotion, the feeling, well, that's written to you.
That's art.
No, there's nothing you can send me, my own true love. There's nothing I'm wishing to be owning. Just to carry yourself back to me unspoiled. I'm across that lonesome ocean.
You came home after 8 months in Italy on your own, and he'd written you these, you know, heartbroken letters full of how much he missed you. And then you came home and discovered he'd been singing about his heartbreak all over the village.
See, there you go.
Was that hard for you?
Yes. Isn't that just like a guy? But he did that. He was working through it, and it became, I think that's typical of him and maybe others also, that what's going on, how you get rid of it is by working on it, whether it's a painting, a play, a novel, or a piece of music.
Well, you write as though it felt to you as if every letter he'd written you had been performed in front of an audience. I mean, did you feel exposed?
Yes, terribly. It was an awful period because I came home and eager to see friends, and all of a sudden I realized all this torturous love affair had been very public, and I didn't like that. I understand it on reflection, but at the time I wasn't happy about that at all.
Listen to me, baby. There's something you must see. I wanna be with you, gal, if you wanna be with me. But if you got to go, it's all right. But if you got to go, go now, or else you got to stay all night.
Could we talk a bit about that iconic photo of the two of you? It's on the cover of your book, but it was the famous album cover for the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. Dylan's in looks like a thin suede jacket. You're walking through snow. You've got nearly knee-high boots on, and you look kind of bundled up in a dark coat, and you're holding onto his arm and kind of snuggling in. You both look freezing. Was it cold?
Yes. It was very cold. It was really very cold, and he just wore a thin suede jacket. And it's understandable, your picture's being taken, you want to look good. But I thought that was ridiculous. It was very thin, and he had a thin shirt underneath.
There's a subtext, though, in the picture. It's a really lovely picture of a young couple in love. But, you know, the subtext is, he's the freewheeling Bob Dylan, you're the anonymous girl on his arm. And you've been saying, you know, you'd been raised to be a woman of substance, not just a musician's chick. Was that one of the tensions that eventually split you up?
Yes, I think that was it. Well, it was the time. It wasn't just us. People would refer to me, oh, you're Bob's chick, and so-and-so is his old lady. If you were married, you were an old lady. And if you were the girlfriend, you were a chick. I mean, how silly is that? And It was pre-feminist times, and all I knew was that I couldn't stand it. Whenever anybody called me chick, I would be furious, but I had no words for it, but it made me angry. I would say, I am not a chick. Don't call me a chick. It was a resentment also that in those years, a girl couldn't go to the movies alone. It meant she was bait. She couldn't sit in a cafe by herself and write or draw or do what the men could do. It meant you were a woman alone and anybody could approach you. So I had all this anger, but not words for it yet.
Did other women begin to enter Bob Dylan's life, and was that part of what drew the two of you apart?
Part of it, yes. As the more famous he got, either people wanted to be my best friend or they wanted to get me out of the way, one way or the other. I mean, that's inevitable with fame. You get more and more people humming around you. And, you know, he was surrounded by people. It was very hard for him also, in a way, to continue working because he began getting all this attention as somehow he had the word, you know. And that was hard because how do you keep working if you think of it? You know, each thing you do is looked upon as, oh, the oracle is writing something. Oh, let's hear what he has to say. It's hard to continue.
So did you ever get angry about the groupies, the other women? Did you fight about it?
It's hard to remember. It was so long ago, no details like that. I mean, I just remember just getting less and less. I just didn't want this life anymore. I just saw it as it was all about music and it was all about folk music. And it really, I would just have to be standing around and waiting, you know? And that wasn't a life I wanted. I had many things I was interested in. And I realized, I just don't want to be sitting back and be some folk musician's chick. But when you're in love with somebody, you know, it was hard for us both, I think, to really separate. We really were young and in love, but our lives were really not working anymore together. You know what I mean? If you reflect on how hard it is when you're young.
Suze Rodelow is an artist in New York City. She talked with Anne Strainchamps about her memoir of Freewheelin' Time.
I once held her in my arms. She said she would always stay.
What's the real legacy of the 60s? Coming up, the rise of the modern conservative movement. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
As defense and as offensive weapon.
Jerry Rubin, speaking to fellow yuppies during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
I mean, I think that, like, people could survive naked, see?
Yeah.
I think you take all your clothes up, a cop won't hit you.
We're talking about war.
There are an awful lot of books about the 60s, but lately a new breed of books has been popping up. Books like X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft, but can still keep everything from sucking. And Slackonomic, Generation X in the Age of Creative Destruction. These books level some harsh critiques at baby boomers, like me. Why? Well, to the best of our knowledge, producer and Gen Xer Charles Monroe Kane might have an answer or two.
As me and the other dads push our strollers to the coffee shop, we talk about a lot of stuff. Bottle weaning, daycare providers, and how to best administer a timeout. But one topic that is sure to come up is you. And by you, I mean the boomers, the 60s generation. And we know you well. You're our parents, our bosses, our elected officials. As you celebrate your milestones on PBS, please realize that something is amiss with your children. Author Christian Lander calls it the rage against the 60s, and it permeates the zeitgeist of Generation X. There's a reason Obama calls himself post-60s. So, truth to power, and you're the power. Are you ready to listen? Okay, then. The 60s are over. You lost. First, you lost the war. Congratulations. Vietnam's still a communist country. You destroyed the village and still couldn't save it. And now we're stuck with a bunch of brass who can't get over the fact that they lost Nam. Their impotence compels them to enter war after war to replenish their lost youth. Thanks a lot. And hippies, don't get smug. Your painted faces and flag burning didn't stop the war. The U.S. got defeated by the Viet Cong, not the Grateful Dead. And you know it. The civil rights movement? Schools are just as segregated today as they were in the 60s. Women's lib? How about still only 75 cents to a dollar, ladies? You pushed? I respect that. But then you stopped. You capitulated under the weight of it all. And frankly, you gave up and sold out. That's one of the many reasons I'm sick and tired of this romantic nostalgia for the hippie. You allow the capitalists you railed against to co-op your culture for minivan commercials. No wonder you ran to Eastern mysticism and materialism after your summer of love. Fill the void, kids. Fill the voids. And oh yeah, thanks for the drugs. Before college, I hitchhiked to San Francisco from my home in Ohio. Freedom, a girl out there with love in her eye and a flower in her hair, all that kind of stuff you taught me. I was idealistic, earnest, and ready for my debut. But along the way, something happened. No, I didn't get pummeled or busted. Something much, much worse happened. I met you. I met you over and over and over and over again in your BMWs with a leather interior. You were mostly male, successful, balding with that cute little ponytail. You were always alone and ready to talk, ready to fill me with your hippie stories of drugs and sex and putting your middle finger up to the man, man. God, to hold her again, joint in my hand, hear Jerry and the boys playing Dark Star. Son, those were the days. Your sadness and guilt filled each car with a thick smell of sulfur. By the time I made it to California with an aching in my heart, you were ready to pass the torch. I was ready to scream at the audacity of your self-centeredness. I'm a Gen Xer. I majored in peace studies. After college, I moved to Europe as an anti-nuke activist. I was meant to follow in your footsteps. It took me years to realize you didn't leave me any. Look, I'm sorry about the Kennedys, but that was before I was born, folks, and I'm almost 40. I think it's time for y'all to move on. But don't fret, I got a suggestion. Two of them, actually. Quit living in the past and get the hell out of our way. You compromised, and then you romanticized your past. You're busy celebrating your youth when you should be ashamed of yourselves. You left us with a legacy of materialism and cynicism. And you know what? We don't appreciate it one bit. Enjoy your retirement. You failed.
Charles Monroe Kane is a producer for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Yes, I know my enemies. They're the teachers who taught me to fight me. Compromise, conformity, assimilation, submission, ignorance. The history of the 60s has, for the most part, been written by the 60s generation itself. Hippies, anti-war protesters, civil rights activists. But there is a new history that's emerging, written by younger historians who don't have those battle scars or fits of nostalgia. Rick Perlstein is one of the leaders of this new crop of historians. In his books Before the Storm and Nixon Land, he argues that the biggest story of the 60s may actually be the rise of the modern conservative movement.
Probably the most lasting change to our political institutions and the way we think about politics in the 1960s was the rise of this backlash against liberalism. The rise of a politician like a Nixon, like a Reagan, like, in fact, the entire right wing of the Republican Party, who appeal to the voter based on the idea that they are going to make you safe and secure in a world that no longer seems safe, no longer seems secure.
Before we go too far into this discussion, we really ought to point out you lay claim to being a liberal yourself. That doesn't mean, though, that you're going to be easy on anyone in this discussion, does it?
Well, people like Abby Hoffman and Time Hayden come in for a bit of abuse in this book. I find them often quite puerile, self-centered, narcissistic. They made it really easy to reject the left in the 60s and the early 70s. I mean, I tell a story about Abby Hoffman. Basically, he was hired by John Lindsay, the liberal mayor of New York, as a liaison to the hippie community. And part of the deal was that he couldn't be arrested. So Abbie Hoffman used to bait the cops into trying to get them to arrest him, even though they knew they couldn't arrest him. And at one point, I tell a story about how he was in the precinct house, and he was totally stoned, of course, and he smashed the precinct's prized trophy case where they kept all their, you know, their regimental decorations. I mean, this was not an act of peace and love. It was an act of anger and resentment.
This, of course, exists on both sides of the story. I'm fascinated, in fact, by what you write about as one of the crucial moments of this, and that's Ronald Reagan running for governor in California. I still don't have a great sense of who he was at that time, but certainly he grasped that the country as a whole was not the liberal monolith that everybody thought was pushing through LBJ's agenda.
Absolutely. Ronald Reagan is a fascinating figure, and I would even say, despite all the imprecations against his intelligence, a political genius. He was the guy who understood that these disorders were actually issues that you can win an election on. He was the first guy to understand that. In fact, his aides would tell him, stop talking about the student uprising at Berkeley. It doesn't show up on our polls. No one cares about the student uprising at Berkeley. And Reagan said, I don't care what your polls say. Every time I mention it, I get a standing ovation. And what happens there is an act of political genius, because Ronald Reagan is basically understanding a new emergent political issue. So new, in fact, that people didn't even know it was something that they could vote based on. So he talks about Berkeley. He talks about orgies so vile I can't even describe them to you. He talks about how Pat Brown, who's the governor he's running against, hasn't picked up these kids by the scruff of their neck. And by the way, Ronald Reagan is remembered as a figure of sunny optimism. But at least during this period, he really focused his rage. He would say things like, hippie is someone who looks like Jane, dresses like Tarzan, and smells like cheetah. You know, someone would hold up a sign saying, make love, not war. And he would say, you don't look like you could do it either. In fact, in the photo section of my book, Nixon Land, I chose a picture of Ronald Reagan, basically his face scrunched up in rage. And that was really the Ronald Reagan who ran for governor in 1966 in California and who won.
You describe this as a period during which the Democrats really didn't understand what was going on. They simply didn't get what Reagan was doing. But what about Richard Nixon? Did he understand what Reagan was accomplishing?
Richard Nixon went to school on Ronald Reagan. In 1966, it was a key year for Richard Nixon's comeback. But what he didn't do was speak about the backlash. He really didn't have a feel for it. It's only the next year, 1967, witnessing how well Reagan does with it, and by the way, George Wallace too, that he begins to pick up this language, this idea that there is a war between black and white in America, and he kind of casts himself as the field marshal almost for the white side.
Looking back, you know, we hear all of the stories of the march in Selma, of Martin Luther King, of the death of Bobby Kennedy, and ignore what was going on, not just in California, but around the country. There really was a change in the way that people were viewing politics. How much of that was an innate change, and how much of it was manipulated?
Manipulated by Richard Nixon, you mean? Yes.
By Nixon and his staff. There were people who were working with him who seemed to know what buttons to push, if you will.
Well, let me give you an example of the manipulation. When in 1970, Richard Nixon was campaigning for congressional candidates and Senate candidates, they had a very specific trick they would do. Whenever he was giving a speech or a campaign rally, they would let in several dozen anti-war protesters because they knew the anti-war protesters would use foul language, they might throw something at the podium, and then Richard Nixon could use that act as the subtext, not even the subtext, as the subject for his speech. And one of the first memos he got when he was president was a warning that that spring in 1969, there would be campus uprisings of a passion and violence that hadn't been seen before. And he didn't write on the memo, how can we prevent this? He wrote on the memo, good, because he knew the more passion, the more division, the more anger there was, the better he would do politically. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't create the wave, but he did a very effective job of surfing the wave.
Looking back at the story that you tell, it is frankly hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Everybody is behaving well. Everybody's behaving badly. Is that a typical story of politics?
I think the 1960s was a time in which nothing was banal. Nothing was boring. Everything was outsized. Everything was the end of the world. Everything was apocalyptic. There was this constant transit between the Lyndon Johnson attitude that we were living in the best of all possible worlds and we were going to enter a new Jerusalem. In fact, when he lit the White House Christmas tree in 1964, he said these are the most hopeful times since Christ was born in Bethlehem. And on the other side, that we were about to face an apocalypse. And there was always this tacking between the two. It was always an age of extremes.
So is that the lesson from all of that? Is that what the contemporary politician can get from looking back? That there are different lessons to be learned from the 60s than we thought there were?
Well, the Republicans chose the lesson from the 1960s that this sort of politicking is effective. It works. David Frum, the former White House speechwriter, in his book on how conservatives can come out of their political doldrums, says, we've been running the exact same presidential campaign since 1972. I mean, we've been running against the hippies. You know, we've been running against the black militants. But at least he argues that the success of that sort of politics fades with each passing day. That's really the question of this 2008 presidential election. Is this mode of politics that Richard Nixon bequeathed to the country still something that the Republicans can squeeze juice from?
Rick Perlstein is an independent historian in Chicago. His latest book is Nixonland: The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What do you think about the 60s? If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Rethinking the 60s, number 824A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Ann Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.